All right, it's time to pull out your number two pencil because it's quiz time. What do the following bands have in common? Cream, Blind Faith, and Derek and the Dominoes. Yeah, I suppose the correct answer could be Eric Clapton, but the answer that I was really looking for was that all three bands were what is known as supergroups. Supergroups are bands that are filled with other guys from other bands who come together to form another band. On paper, a supergroup sounds like a terrific idea. But the problem with a supergroup is that they sometimes come with super problems. And sometimes those super problems are among the many reasons why those guys are no longer in those other groups. And that's often why most supergroups break up super fast. Because sometimes those problems combined with additional problems cause much bigger problems. And today's album from Baxi's enormous record collection falls into that exact category. A supergroup that was completely doomed from the very start. And thankfully, they lasted long enough to make one incredible statement. Today, we're going to look at one of my favorite albums from 1977. It's the album LAMF from Johnny Thunders and the Heartbreakers on Baxi's Musical Podcast.
What is it?
It's Baxi's Musical Podcast.
On paper, it all looked so damn good. You had Johnny Thunders and Jerry Nolan of the New York Dolls. You had Richard Hell from the influential early New York underground band Television. And of course, you eventually had Walter Luhr from the band The Demons, who had certainly been influenced by the New York Dolls. But unfortunately, this was a band that was often known for being under the influence more than who they were influenced by or those that they would go on to influence later. And while much of their reputation is both historically accurate and perhaps very well deserved, it tends to overshadow the fact that their one and only album together is maybe one of the best rock and roll records ever made. And since the unfortunate death earlier this year of the band's last surviving member, guitarist Walter Luhr, it's time to give the Heartbreakers some long overdue reconsideration. So let's go back a bit. November 2nd, 1972. Approximately 6 months before the New York Dolls would begin recording their debut album, drummer Billy Mercia died from an accidental overdose in London at the age of 21. The band were just about to wrap up their tour in England and were forced to cancel their final show. Because the Dolls had a recording contract ready to go with Mercury Records, they auditioned a number of drummers right away. And among those auditioning for the drumming position would be Mark Bell, who would later go on to play with Richard Hell and the Voidoids, as well as the Ramones under the name Marky Ramone. Also auditioning was future Kiss drummer Peter Criss. But the guy who got the job was Jerry Nolan. Nolan had played with Susie Quattro, Billy Squire, Wayne County, and by April of 1973, the New York Dolls with Jerry Nolan were in the studio, and by July, they would release their debut record. So here's the problem. Back in 1973, you either loved the New York Dolls or you just didn't get it. There wasn't a whole lot of middle ground here. And the tensions between the band, in combination with a growing reliance on heroin by guys like Jerry Nolan, Johnny Thunders, and bass player Walter Killer Kane, would lead to the inevitable demise of the New York Dolls. And in the final moments of the band's shelf life, in 1975, they released one more album and were temporarily managed by future Sex Pistols manager Malcolm McLaren. But frankly, the band was well past falling apart. Walter Kane was barely coherent enough to play bass. Johnny and Jerry, whose heroin addictions had been steadily getting worse, wound up having a huge fallout with lead singer David Johansen, and that pretty much did it for the New York Dolls. Now, obviously, it's a much more complicated story than that, and it's a story that I've already talked about in a previous episode. But on the very same week that the New York Dolls officially broke up, the same sort of thing was happening with bass player Richard Hell in the band Television. In 1973, Richard, along with Tom Verlaine, started the band that would become one of the very first bands to play at the famous CBGBs in New York. By 1975, nearly a year before recording their first album, Marquee Moon, Richard Hell quit the band feeling as though his contributions were suddenly being marginalized. Add that to his growing paranoia and reliance on heroin, and you can see why a guy like Richard Hell would feel right at home hanging out with guys like Johnny Thunders and Jerry Nolan of the New York Dolls. For Johnny and Jerry, they were ready to leave the New York Dolls behind them and form a band on their own. And with Richard Hell suddenly available, they asked him to join along, and he gladly accepted. They decided to call themselves the Heartbreakers. And on May 30th, 1975, the Heartbreakers played their very first gig as a trio at a rock club in Queens known as the Coventry. And while that went pretty well, they felt they needed a second guitar player. More importantly, Johnny Thunders wasn't entirely comfortable in the role of being the primary frontman of the band all by himself. And so after a series of auditions, the band hired Walter Luhr from the Demons to play guitar and share in the vocal duties with Richard and Johnny. And on July 4th, 1975, just 2 months later, the four-member version of the Heartbreakers played their very first gig at CBGB's. The band was an instant club favorite, quickly becoming one of the most popular bands both at CBGB's and at Max's Kansas City. This was punk rock's very first supergroup, and by all accounts, the Heartbreakers were becoming the most exciting band in New York at the time. They sounded freaking great, they looked incredible, the songs were a combination of Chuck Berry and the Rolling Stones and every drug-addled stereotype you can possibly imagine. And with that, almost from the start, the Heartbreakers went out to search for a record deal. Unfortunately, record companies were scared to death of these guys, not because they weren't great, but because their reputation as self-destructive heroin junkies seemed to be too much of a liability. Of course, when you're singing songs about Chinese rocks and too much junkie business, it's hard to make the case that the record companies were wrong. And yet, those that saw them live would attest that the Heartbreakers were something pretty special. Each member standing out, contributing songs, sharing lead vocals, and doing massive amounts of heroin in between. Yet, they were headlining shows and drawing attention all over the city and throughout the Northeast. And the most popular song in the Heartbreakers' arsenal was the song Chinese Rocks. Chinese Rocks was a song that was originally written in 1975 by Dee Ramone of the Ramones. But their lead singer, Joey Ramone, wasn't exactly crazy about the overtly blatant references within the song about selling your stuff to buy heroin. Richard Hell, on the other hand, had no problem with this kind of thing, and so he offered up a few lyrical ideas to punch things up. Suddenly, Chinese Rocks was being performed regularly by the Heartbreakers. And even though the Ramones would eventually record their own version of the song nearly 4 years later, Dee Dee and Richard would spend the next several years arguing over who wrote which parts and when. And that would remain a bone of contention until 2002, when Dee Dee Ramone died of an accidental overdose of Chinese Rocks. Also among the earlier songs performed by the Heartbreakers was a song written by Richard Hell called The Blank Generation. Originally, it had been written while Richard was still a member of Television, and while the song would go on to become an early punk rock anthem, he never got a chance to perform a song until he joined the Heartbreakers. But because there was almost no record company interested in signing the Heartbreakers to a contract, Richard would have to wait until he left the Heartbreakers in May of 1976 to finally release The Blank Generation with his band, The Voidoids. Which brings me to my next point, why Richard Hell left the Heartbreakers. During his last few months with the band, Richard began assuming creative control from Johnny, Jerry, and Walter, insisting that he should be the one handling most of the lead vocal duties. His assumption of control came to a head during a rehearsal in Boston when he insisted that Johnny only be allowed to sing just two songs during an upcoming set. This prompted Johnny to get up and walk out the door. And fed up with Richard's attitude, the other two guys left as well. And suddenly, Richard Hell was out of the band. After Boston, the band wasted almost no time at all auditioning new bass players, and within a few weeks, they settled with bass player Billy Rath from Boston. Finally, the Heartbreakers were complete and ready to go. In the fall of 1976, the Heartbreakers were invited to come to England by former New York Dolls manager Malcolm McLaren. The idea was for the Heartbreakers to join Malcolm's newest client, the Sex Pistols, for their infamous Anarchy Tour. This was to be a tour that included not only the Sex Pistols, but the Clash and the Damned as well. The Heartbreakers accepted the offer and arrived in London on December 1st, 1977. Now, that date's important because in the very same afternoon, the Sex Pistols appeared on an interview with BBC television host Bill Grundy. During this interview, Grundy provoked the Pistols to say something naughty, to which the Sex Pistols obliged. And the following day, the Sex Pistols were torn apart in the London press for their vulgarity. And as a result, the plan for the Anarchy Tour fell apart, leaving the Heartbreakers stuck in London with almost no money. Despite wanting to fly back home to New York, the Heartbreakers' manager, Lee Black Childers, convinced the band to stay in London, thinking that they might be able to be more successful amongst the growing punk scene in the UK. And he was right. After only a few gigs around London, the Heartbreakers were finally offered a record deal, the one that they had been waiting for the last 2.5 years. The band was signed to Track Records, which was owned by Kit Lambert and Chris Stamp, the former managers of The Who. And on February 1st, the Heartbreakers finally began recording the demos for what would become the first few tracks of their debut album. In between these sessions, they performed two shows at London's Speakeasy, which was recorded and released many years later. But after those shows, the band recorded the final eight tracks for the album, and that's when things started to get interesting. Somewhere during the recording process, the band came up with this great idea to have each member of the band go into a different studio and mix their own versions of these songs, which might have been a great idea had we been talking about a band other than the Heartbreakers. To make the individual mixes possible, the band was using multiple studios located around London and in Birmingham, more than 2 hours away from each other. The guys would take cabs to get to the studios, charge Track Records for the rides, and then use the extra money to buy drugs. And as a result, it would take 6 months before the album was finally complete. And the result of the final album sounded horrible. Parts of this were due to the fact that Jerry Nolan manipulated his way into having his mixes used to complete the album, claiming that if they didn't use his mixes, then he would quit the band. And in fact, he would quit the band and be temporarily replaced by Sex Pistols drummer Paul Cook. Eventually, Jerry returned, but only if they used his mixes of the album. And like I said, they sounded terrible. Much of that had to do with the fact that Jerry's heroin use had become so out of control that he failed to notice that they were terrible. And yet, they were used anyway. So on October 3rd, 1977, the album LAMF by Johnny Thunders and the Heartbreakers was finally released. So why have I chosen an album that sounds like crap? Well, part of that has to do with the fact that even with the album being mixed by self-described junkies, the songs were frickin' fantastic. And in fact, if the mixing had been done by a proper engineer, then it's very possible that this album would have been one of the greatest albums of all time. Instead, it was a great album that was accidentally made by some of the most messed up people in rock history. And that's why they titled the album LAMF, which stood for Like a Motherfucker. And it was. In 1982, Trax Records went out of business, and Heartbreakers manager Lee Black Childers obtained the rights to the album's master tapes. From there, Childers contacted Johnny Thunders and former Generation X guitar player Tony James to remix the tapes themselves, becoming the first of many attempts to fix the original mixes. They were remixed again in 1994, and finally in 2012, the definitive version of LAMF was released, and while the sound was marginally better, what you really got to hear was one of the most exciting bands of its time struggle to put together one of the most definitive rock classic albums ever, with great songs like Chinese Rocks, Born to Lose, All by Myself, Pirate Love. They were like the Rolling Stones if the Rolling Stones were caught in a crippling drug problem. Of course, the Heartbreakers never got around to recording another studio album, but they did release a few live albums from previously recorded performances like the ones I mentioned earlier. And the band would periodically reform from time to time, but by then, their demons would eventually catch up to each one of them. In 1991, Johnny Thunders died of an apparent overdose, although under some pretty questionable circumstances. Jerry Nolan would die the following year from a stroke he suffered while being treated for pneumonia. Billy Rath left the music business, fought his addiction issues, became an addiction specialist, but died in 2014 at the age of 64. And Walter Luhr, avoiding many of the same pitfalls as his former bandmates, became a stockbroker, but died early this year after a battle with cancer. Yes, the Heartbreakers are punk rock's first and possibly most important supergroup. And while they only released one album, the album is freaking amazing. Amazing that it was as good as it was, and amazing that it was made at all, considering how the band was caught in a thickly layered fog of overwhelming chemical excess. And while it's considered to be a punk rock classic, it's really not. It's really just a tremendously great rock and roll record that deserves to be given its proper consideration and praise and place among some of the greatest records ever recorded. It really is a true gem, like a real motherfucker. Next time on Baxi's Enormous Record Collection, we're going to take a look at a record that was recorded in 1971, but wouldn't see the light of day until 4 years later. That's next time on Baxi's Musical Podcast.